Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about the quality of water in central Indiana and the challenges confronting us in maintaining any kind of quality of water. I have as my guest today David Sherman, who is the director of the Indianapolis Public Works Department, the VP of Communications and Community Affairs for Veolia Water, Lou Ann Baker, and the director of the water policy director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Angela Hamm. Thank you all for joining me. It's good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Wanted to start. I'd also like to ask our listeners to join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to start a little bit and just talk first about the challenges that confront us in terms of maintaining water quality here in the Indianapolis area. And I think I'll throw that one first to David Sherman of the Indianapolis Public Works Department.
Well, we have a lot of challenges. You know, we have our water quality and water requirements that we have, the water demand from the water department. We have our stormwater issues with flooding throughout the United States and throughout the county. And we have also the issues of the sewage system and the federally mandated required $3.5 billion consent decree, which requires to stop combined sewer overflows and also look at how to get rid of some of our failing septic systems. And so all that impacts the water table. So those are some of the challenges we have. And of course, like everything else, as we're growing, the amount of water that we have available to us and beneficial reuse and things that we can do with those resources that are available.
Lou Ann Baker, what do you think the challenges are?
As David pointed out, there are many. We have seasonal variations in flow in the streams that supply our drinking water as well as the streams that the city discharges into. Those are impacted by temperature. They're impacted by rain and turbidity. They're impacted by the agricultural nature of where we sit, in that 79% of our watershed is agriculturally influenced, which means...
Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure.
Break it down. I know you all know, and all of you are nodding your heads, but I'm a little bit worried that folks out there, when they hear multisyllabic words there, begin to think they don't know what they're talking about or don't understand what we are talking about here. So could you break that down a little bit?
Sure. There are lots of different things to go into the water supply, into the surface water that brings water into our treatment plants. Some of those are man-made. Mm-hmm. Some of those are caused by nature. For example, even when it rains, you get a lot of mud, rock, runoff into those streams, all of which have to be dealt with, obviously, before water comes through your tap. Those things impact the system in different ways, mm-hmm. and they're influenced by many different factors.
A simple example of that is many of us now, we all want to have these green gardens and yards, and you have these fertilizers that you use. And for those who have a swimming pool, for example, they've found that this year trying to keep the disinfection working longer is harder because of the runoff from during a rain of that product going into your water. Well, that same thing goes into your water beds. The same thing happens with the river that we have. So as an example, just the fertilizers that are used out there in gardens have impact.
Angela Hamm, what are your organization's largest concerns about?
Our largest concerns are about protecting our source water in Indiana, the water that Veolia uses to supply our drinking water. We have 822 water bodies in Indiana that are impaired in some way. The highest impairment would be E. coli, which is a pathogen that's created by human waste as well as animal waste. And the other impairments are mostly nutrient-related, which once again is created by wastewater discharge as well as agriculture discharge. Given the federal mandate on most of our municipal sewer systems, those issues are being addressed from a human perspective, but we're not doing much to address what is impacting our waters from an agricultural perspective. So one of my major focuses is regulation of the agriculture industry as an industry rather than as the typical conventional family farmer that it used to be.
Well, and what sort of regulation would you like to see?
There are numerous regulations actually in the works right now. In 2008, the EPA was required, as a result of a lawsuit from several public interest groups, to redo their confined animal feeding operation rules. As a result, those rules have now trickled down to the state of Indiana, and we are, in fact, in the process of revising those rules, which develop certain waste management criteria for industrial agriculture, for animals, livestock production, for animals that are kept in confinement more than 45 days of the year. We also are in the process of working with the Office of Indiana State Chemist as a result of a legislative mandate that came out of the Indiana legislature last year to develop new rules for the land application, not only of commercial fertilizers, but also fertilizers from animal waste.
How did we, David mentioned earlier that we're under an EPA consent decree right now and spending about $3.5 billion to meet the terms of that consent decree. How did we get to that point?
Well, there are 760 communities similar to ours where have combined sewers and combined sewer overflows. And, for example, a half inch of rain in downtown Indianapolis can put 180 million gallons of sewage into the at the plant, and that's a lot of sewage all at one time, which means it goes over into White River. White River is a source of water that's reclaimed and used by the from our water side. So the federal government long ago decided that we needed to start cleaning up and separating those and having the waters that are, you know, rain waters and storm waters running in back into the streams, and so that was part of it. The city negotiated for 6 years until 2006 and came up with a consent decree that basically was going to require the city to build 30-foot tunnels and a lot of things inside. I want to point out that since 2008 when we came in, we realized that the consent decree, the federal mandate, and that was in $2004, mm-hmm. and by the year 2025, they had to build all these tunnels, and we realized that the facility they were going to build might not be the right thing. Yeah, we had almost 400 million in overruns. So we have negotiated with the EPA twice since that time and have just come up with a new consent decree, which will save us over $760 million, and we'll pick up 7 billion gallons of sewage earlier, which is a good thing, faster, quicker.
What were the changes that were made in the renegotiation?
In the renegotiations, what we realized is that when we take a holistic approach and look at the city, that we needed a deep rock tunnel that was going to be able to have a place to go, kind of a bathtub effect, because what we were finding is the other solutions were going to take sewage from the north side to a little further south and a little bit further south, but basically upsetting homes and areas. We weren't going to take care of all the drainage issues. So we came up with an approach that put a larger interceptor or a large, which that means is another big pipe from the north side to the south side alongside the ones that we had, and we put it into a big storage basin before it got to the treatment plants. That was important because it saved us some money, but it basically meant we were able to pick up more sewage and get rid of some of the what they call combined sewer overflow units around the rivers and pick them up earlier. The biggest ones are, one of them is CSO number 8, which is about 1 billion gallons a year. And we were able to pick that up earlier and bring it in to that basin. That was one change. We also, as we were talking about nutrients and removal, we had an activated sludge system that was going to be built that was running about $194 million. And through the mayor's approach to performance management, we were able to bid it out a more successful activated sludge, which is an aerobic air is used and all, for $54 million. So we saved that much money. And yet we're going to have better quality water that can handle industrial users better and go forward. So those are some of the things that we did.
Angela Hamm, I'm going to ask you the same question we started this with. How did we get to this point where we have to reclaim all of this stuff?
We got to this point because the state of Indiana was in violation of the Clean Water Act. That's the basic premise of this mandate. And the federal government, because they have delegated the state authority to implement the requirements of the Clean Water Act, has the ability to mandate that we meet those requirements. And the Hoosier Environmental Council, it's our perspective that the state of Indiana is still out of compliance with the Clean Water Act.
In what ways?
In fact, we have actually asked the federal government to de-delegate the state's authority to issue national pollutant discharge elimination system permits, which are permits that allow industry to pollute our waterways legally. And we have actually asked that they withdraw authority or de-delegate the authority to the state of Indiana on the fact that our general permit program is illegal and the fact that we are not addressing agriculture effectively.
And could you give some specific examples of the ways there were in violation of?
Sure. We have general permits under the law here that were originally designed by the legislature in the early 1990s to address industries that have similar, supposedly similar pollutants that they discharge into our waterways. And the reason that those are illegal is because those permits do not last the same time span that a national pollutant discharge elimination system permit should last. They're 7-year permits rather than 5-year permits. And also they're issued currently by the Water Pollution Control Board, which by statute is required to have an industry representative. So you basically have self-regulation occurring. EPA has in fact written a letter to the state agency indicating that these general permits are in fact illegal and in violation of the Clean Water Act. Furthermore, we're indicating that the program that Indiana has currently to deal with our agriculture is in violation of the Clean Water Act because, once again, it allows industry to self-select their level of regulation. You can deem your facility as not having the potential to pollute. That way you self-select out of the more arduous permit program into a permit by rule.
Go ahead, David Sherman. You want to?
I think it's important for the general public to know that with MPDS permits, every community, a McDonald's has a basically a certain discharge limit, system they're allowed to focus on how much grease and all. So with the MPDS permits, they're very challenging. And as we go on later on, maybe we can talk about the cost because, for example, the city of Birmingham went bankrupt trying to meet some of these standards because they couldn't do it. They didn't talk to the EPA and get things worked out, and maybe talk about why the city of Indiana
so
was able to.
Whether it does that argue for a more proactive approach, Lou Ann Baker, or?
Well, I think proactive is usually better than reactive in most cases. David's focused on really EPA and what they've done on raw sewage. Angela's mentioned some of the agriculture and some of the state limitations. I think from the water utilities perspective, we also want your listeners to understand what they can do from a behavioral standpoint. Again, David mentioned with their lawn fertilizers and not using phosphorus, farmers in their agricultural settings and using buffers and following the recommended application processes, all of which individuals can personally choose to have a better impact on their overall water source and water quality.
And that's probably, I think, where we'll take it. We're going to take a short break right now to thank the people who make this program possible. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Shooting us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or sending us a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We're talking about water and Indianapolis's water quality. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay with us.
Listening to an encore presentation of No Limits. so we won't be taking any phone calls during the show. Thanks a lot for listening.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking about the water quality here in Indianapolis and central Indiana. My guests today are David Sherman, Director of Indianapolis Public Works, Luann Baker, who is the VP of Communications and Community Affairs for Veolia Water, and Water Policy Director Angela Hamm of the Hoosier Environmental Council. We're having a conversation really about Luann Baker right before the break was talking about the ways that people could make behavioral choices that would affect water quality here in the region. I guess what I'd like to go to is talking about really what some of these changes, the attempt we're making to rebuild the infrastructure here, how that will affect people at their, the level at which they live, when they turn the tap on, when they do whatever, and perhaps talk about some of the other choices that they could make to improve quality of water here in Indianapolis and central Indiana, and in the process perhaps reduce costs as well. Luann Baker, since you had the floor last, we'll throw it back to you if that's okay. What choices could they make? How is this going to affect them?
Every household, every user, every business can look at their daily uses of water. If it's brushing their teeth, if it's standing, whatever you stand at the sink at, turn the water off when you're performing, again, shaving, brushing your teeth, whatever. If you have a dishwasher or a washing machine, make sure it's full when you run it. We have plenty of source water now to deal with the needs and the demands of our existing customers. That water supply amount is not going to change substantially. We can go drill more wells and look for more sources, but to David's point earlier, what we need to do is to be sure that we're using the water that we have as wisely as we can use it. It's much more cost-effective for all of us to use what we have rather than to spend literally hundreds of millions of dollars to go out and build new facilities to process additional water when the facilities we have today, in most cases, are very sufficient to meet the average daily demand of our customers.
Is this what we're talking about here really primarily an educational challenge with people? I mean, we are obviously all Americans right here, and one of the sort of central myths of the American frontier was limitless possibility, limitless resources. We seem to be running into limits now, and we have to readjust our thinking. David Sherman, you're looking pensive when I say that, or do you?
I've been in the water and wastewater business since 1970. Okay. And I always think about one of my clients in Clark County Sand District in Las Vegas, Nevada. You know, you go there and people come from New Jersey wanting to have a New Jersey lawn in the middle of an area where you should have basically used natural habitat. And I think it's foreign for the people in Indianapolis to think that they should be looking at natural habitat and basically how they use the watering systems, how they use their products, because they think it's just going to keep coming. Quite frankly, White River, great resource, but the effluent from that treatment plant, the two treatment plants, Southport and Belmont, is much cleaner than that river that it goes into. And that's something we have to look at. So I was just kind of smiling because, when you've been doing this for a long time, you realize that there's ways to save water and save and reuse the water. People need to understand that we will have to spend millions of dollars at some point in time taking the secondary effluent off of industries and all that and then push it down and recharge some of our water resources, because that'll be another source of going forward. That's why as we go out and the mayor promotes rain gardens, green alleys, pervious pavement, things of that nature that take the storm water and put it back into the basins that hold the water and recharge the basins are very important. But the water conservation techniques are there. But Indianapolis, like everybody else in this country, needs to figure out how to use their water better.
Yeah, it's a resource that is fixed? And as the pressures are growing, it's almost like a math problem in that you've got a fixed resource. You're not going to make more water as time goes on. Well, Go ahead, Luann.
To David's point, on an average day, the water utility produces about 140 million gallons of drinking water.
Uh-huh.
Again, that's an annual average. That will fluctuate in the summer when people are outside watering their lawn, primarily using pools, washing their car, whatever they're doing. That number will fluctuate to 200 and as high as 228 million gallons, 140 to 228. That's a lot of water going on lawns.
Mm-hmm.
And what we need to understand and establish is green grass, and you always know George on the block, whatever George's name is, who has to have the greenest grass and waters his lawn, you know, 15 times a day for half an hour, and it goes squish, squish, but it's a really pretty green lawn.
Even in a drought,
Green grass is not really the most, if I can use the word green in quotation, concept because of the application of that drinking water, which could be used in a better situation for better purposes.
Yeah, we're starting actually to get calls, tweets, and emails. I'm gonna throw the conversation here with an email from Richard Cockrum, and I'll just read it. It says, "It is my understanding that IDEM is promulgating rules to limit phosphate runoff, but only in impoundments that are used for drinking water. Does that rule include the White River? And if not, why?" Anybody familiar with this?
I am, in fact, familiar with the plan to promulgate rules for phosphorus in our waters. In fact, there was a public notice put out for comment just recently about phosphorus in lakes and reservoirs. It is the plan long-term to have an additional rule for nitrogen in lakes and reservoirs, phosphorus in rivers and streams, and then nitrogen in rivers and streams. So they are regulating the totality of our waterways, but they're doing it in a piecemeal fashion. So he is correct. It is limited at this point to our lakes and our reservoirs. That is the first level that it will be dealt with. IDEM has accepted public comments. The public comment period has expired, and they are actually populating a work group on this issue so we can come to some agreement on this regulation, hopefully by early spring.
Yes, Luann Baker.
There's also, we understand, potential legislation that may be introduced this year that would ban phosphorus in lawn fertilizers. And people may ask, well, why does that matter? If you look on your bag of fertilizer, if you're a self-applier, there's a middle number, and that's the number that determines the level of phosphorus in there. Generally in Indiana, grass in most people's lawns has very sufficient phosphorus. The ground has sufficient phosphorus and doesn't need it added. What happens when you add more is the excess then runs off ultimately into our waterways. What that does to the water quality is it makes algae grow. Like the little Pac-Man, if you think of the algae as a little Pac-Man.
Which is why it was hard to keep the swimming pools, as David Sherman said earlier.
I think it's kind of interesting because in the summer, a lot of us throughout the city, in a lot of areas, we'll get a lot of calls in about the taste and odor of their water.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the rules, people don't want to have new rules, and they just don't want to have requirements like this. But the algae growth and things that are going on in the reservoirs and that impact us require the water plant, for example, to use activated carbon to get rid of that taste and odor and all. But the reason they have it is because people have to have the green lawn with the XYZ a product on it. And I'm as bad as everybody else about that. That's why I put a rain guard in recently. And by the way, it works. It's cutting down the water bill. But it is one of the challenges that we have because we have a certain standard and we want to try to look like we never have to give in. And the fact of the matter is if we want quality water that tastes good and it doesn't infect your cooking or any of those kind of things, we're going to have some rules that adjust.
What is the cost? The green lawn has become kind of a symbol in this conversation now. In some ways, what is we've talked about the cost in terms of environment. What is the financial cost of that kind of lawn vanity? I mean, how much do we spend as a community just on keeping the grass green that could be rediverted in other ways?
It depends on the size of the lawn.
And
if you look at the way the city's structured, generally the older part of the city has smaller lawns. The farther out you go with development, you see larger lawns and potentially in-ground irrigation systems. Again, we're looking at somewhere during hot summers from somewhere between 70 and 100 million gallons of water going on grass.
70 and 100 million
70 to 100 million gallons per day.
Per day.
Per day.
And how much does that cost? roughly? Can we get a ballpark on that? I know.
Are you talking about for the resident?
Yeah. Well, overall. If we could go per resident, say.
The fact of the matter is that the water is a very, very cheap resource. And we, matter of fact, and for the city of Indianapolis, sewage, your sewage treatment costs, your solid waste costs are cheaper than 90% of the communities throughout the country. It's on the low end and has been. The problem with the water is it's so cheap and so reasonable. It's not a financial risk. So I've got a pretty good sized lawn and all that. If I'm really out there watering, my bill might go up to $70 from 19. But it's for 3 months, and what do I care? That's not a lot of money in the sense of it because of the cost per thousands of gallons.
Yeah, that's a dinner out.
You know, it's a dinner out, exactly. And yet it's kind of funny because people go around and pay $3 or $2 for a bottle of water. If we charge that amount of money, we could build a lot of infrastructure, you know.
Without question.
So,
okay. We have a call right now that I think we'll take. Ryan, are you with us?
Good afternoon, yes.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks for joining the program. You have a question.
Yes. I get an email every time it rains in Indianapolis, and it's from Department of Public Works, and it states that in some instances when rain occurs over a quarter of an inch, that raw sewage can dump into White River. And I guess my question is, number one, is that true? And number two, if it is, how big a concern is it? To me, it's a big concern because I see people fishing and water skiing and boating in White River and swimming. And is all this true? I assume DPW is not lying to me, but is it a big deal?
Yeah, it's a big enough deal that, like I say, in 2004 dollars, we are going to spend $3.5 billion separating combined sewers. But what that means is by the year 2025, when the tunnels and all would have been finished, over $5.4 billion.
Well, I guess my question is, would it be concerned the health factor?
No, the water quality has been improving steadily as we've been moving along. Right now, White River, the creeks and all are starting to clean up. You'll notice, I don't know where you live, but for example, if you went out to a college in Fall Creek area there, you'll see that we've put in some rain gardens where we're trying to separate sewage and water. And what we've already seen in that area that the streams along there are actually starting to improve because you can start to see the bottom where instead of even being black.
Is it safe to swim? Is it safe to eat the fish out of White River? Is it
White River safe to swim out to fish out of? But I wouldn't be swimming.
Could I jump in real quickly?
Sure.
We've used this term rain garden.
Yes.
A couple of times. Could we offer a definition of that real quickly?
Sure. We have installed a rain garden is basically where the water percolates through the ground. And basically what you do is by putting a rain garden in, you have a certain you adjust the rain or adjust the ground and plant a lot of natural habitat, which has deeper roots. And it will start deepening. It'll take the water, absorb it, and the roots will get very large. They'll go down 10, 12 feet. And you'll have these pretty natural habitat going on. It absorbs the water, pulls it in, and instead of going running off everywhere, it'll absorb. And like I say, we put a green garden in it off of College and Fall Creek there. We put a test program in, and so far, when we've had major storms, the natural habitat have absorbed all of the stormwater, and so therefore it's being absorbed there and then going back into the ground instead of running into the creek.
What sorts of things go into that natural habitat? I mean, if some
grass, when you're talking about what kind of thing,
yeah.
It's different kinds of grass, plants. I don't have a list of them, but if you go look on the Office of Sustainability, we have a whole list of those sitting there.
Okay.
And they're pretty reasonable.
Okay. Ryan, did we get your question answered?
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture.
No.
it's getting better every day.
Okay.
You can thank your mayor for that.
But it's getting better. Okay.
Thank you for calling,
Ryan.
Thank you. Thanks for joining the program. We also have a tweet here, and it says, is there any reclamation of floodwaters that go through the treatment facilities, and would that alleviate some places that live in flood-prone areas?
Okay.
Does that help? You want me to run through that again? Would that?
I think one of the areas, let's talk about Frog Hollow. Read the newspaper this weekend on Saturday, we've had an area on the south side near Troy and Bluff that has historically flooded every time there's any kind of rain of any sort. 80% of the areas and homes are flooded out. And we have now, we're putting a wetlands in and a deferred area where now 80 or 90% of the time when there's major rains there, they will not be flooded within a year. And again, what are we doing? We're putting a stream in. We're putting natural habitat in. It will now be a very nice area that people can walk and absorb and look at, and there'll be a lot of ducks and butterflies there, and it'll be kind of cool. The green garden I talked about on 57th Street is an example. The pervious pavement that the mayor put on down on Ohio Street in a green alley we just did recently up north. Those are some of the natural ways that we can absorb water, and it will stop runoff going elsewhere. STEM Court last year, they were at ones where if it rained, that half-inch rain they talk about, their cars would be flooded. And now, because of the way we've adjusted and put some stormwater systems in, it can be raining very, very heavily, and it's fine. And it's one of the mayor's major achievements, I think, Mayor Ballard.
How old is our infrastructure here? I mean, it's Lou Ann Baker is actually laughing so hard she's about ready to fall out of her chair here.
But. We have drinking water pipes that are more than 125 years old. In the system that people drink, obviously, consumable water from every day.
From the Ulysses S. Grant administration period, basically.
Believe it or not, which is foreign to some people, but again, they're under the ground. No one ever sees them. They're, for the most part, working very well. But many of our water treatment facilities, I mean, were actually built during our great-grandfather's time. So our White River plant, our biggest plant, was built in 1906. Fall Creek, the plant at the fairgrounds that most people are, that's one of our most visible plants that people drive past, was built in the 30s and 40s. So, I mean, the facilities are old. They require a tremendous upkeep and maintenance. The federal government would like to keep making updates and upgrades and mandates available. So you have to keep working with what you have. But in answer to your question, we have a lot of very old facilities, a lot of very, very old pipe. That in most cases are doing their job well every day. However, at some point, you reach an end of a useful life, you have a main break, and you have new pavement that Mr. Sherman has just put down, unfortunately, which has just been disrupted by an 80-year-old pipe that decided it was tired today and no longer going to do its job.
Yeah, metal fatigue or whatever, and broke down. And I guess that's what where I would like to take this. We've got just about 2 minutes until the next break, so we probably will have to pick this up on the other side, but perhaps we can get started. Were a lot of these needs possible to anticipate, say, 25, 30 years ago? Angela Hamm?
I was not around 25 years ago to
great.
Anticipate
these. Great, make me feel
needs.
Old. Thank you.
I was in grade
all right.
school.
All right.
didn't mean to make you feel old. But it's my understanding that, yes, they were. It's my understanding that former Indianapolis administrations, in fact, did research the cost of separating our sewer system, our sanitary sewer system, from our stormwater sewer system, and at a time during that administration, and it was previous to my living in the area, the cost was estimated at about $20 million, and the plan was discarded, they were not going to do it. It was too costly. Indianapolis is not the only community that has anticipated that this need would arise. There are other communities around the state of Indiana that have also anticipated that these needs would arise. So we're paying more now to separate the infrastructure than we would have in the past. And Dave can elaborate or contradict me if he prefers.
Okay.
But that is my understanding of the plan and how it came to fruition.
Well, we're going to take a short break to thank the people who make this program possible. You're listening to No Limits. I'm John Krall, your host. I'd like to invite you to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. We're talking about Indianapolis's water quality and the ways that we can anticipate the needs for the future. Please stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
You're listening to an encore presentation of No Limits, so we won't be taking any phone calls during the show. Thanks a lot for listening.
Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We're talking today about water quality here in central Indiana, and I'm joined by Indianapolis Public Works Director David Sherman, Veolia Water VP of Communications and Community Affairs, Luann Baker, and Hoosier Environmental Council Water Policy Director, Angela Hamm. We were talking really about whether the challenges we're facing now could have been anticipated 25, 30 years ago, and Angela was saying yes. In fact, there seems to be some evidence that they were anticipated. David Sherman, you have a slightly different view.
I think the issue here is there's two couple issues. One is as technology has improved, we've been able to measure, you know, things at a much lower level than before. And as we've learned and grown as the industry's changed, we've been able to measure in much lower numbers, and as we've been able to measure at those lower numbers, we have enforced regulations to those levels to some extent. I would think that 70 years ago, when a lot of these combined sewers were put in, you know, it would just be natural to say it would just be okay because people, you know, dilution was the solution. It's why our oceans and other areas, City of Los Angeles, had to go to a no-sludge outfall. But they had an outfall 5 miles out. Nobody saw anything. It wasn't a big deal. But as time's going on, populations have grown, we've gone forward. In this particular case, for the city of Indianapolis, I'd like to point out that during HUDNET's time, they actually put in some pretty sophisticated wastewater treatment plants with ozone and all, but it's changed. I will say that the changes that this administration has made to the consent decree will be longer lasting, and we would actually save money because although it was 3.5, the $20 billion was going to be putting in another system that wouldn't have matched up with today's requirements. Doesn't take into consideration some of the nutrient requirements. So it's easy to point a finger. I also smile because when you talk about how old our systems are, we recently had a break across Fall Creek, one of the river or one of our creeks here, and we actually pulled up a system was from the 1870s. And it was so unique because it looked like a shotgun barrel that our guys all wanted to come out and take pictures of because they'd never seen anything like it before. What we had to do, though, was figure out how to preserve it because it becomes a historical factor. So just that was the thing I was smiling about.
Was there historic preservation for your water treatment?
For wastewater plants, yes.
Well, and I guess where I'm going, the second shoe on this question is, what challenges are there likely to be out there 30 years from now that we're not anticipating now? Angela Hamm, you're nodding your head sagely over there. So
I think we're anticipating them. I think people that are educated on this issue are anticipating them. We've talked about changing our behaviors from a water utility perspective, but we haven't talked about changing other behaviors that are impacting our water quality today and will continue to denigrate our water in the future. Our reliance on coal-fired power plants, for instance, that creates air pollution, but that air pollution has to dissipate somewhere, and it's dissipating over our waterways, and it's harming our aquatic communities, and it's harming our waters. And it also proliferates coal mining in southern Indiana, and there's a phenomenon called acid mine drainage, where even abandoned coal mines that have been reclaimed, when water flows through these mines into the waters of our state of Indiana, their pH is higher. They are containing heavy metals that they would not have normally contained just by those activities. So those of us that have educated ourselves on this issue, we're anticipating these problems. But people in the general population that may not think in this way probably are not anticipating those problems. But I think our reliance on coal-fired power plants here in Indiana is going to become a water issue as well as an air issue in the future.
We're now getting a lot of questions on this subject, so I'm going to take a couple of them. We've gotten several tweets that are variations on a theme that I'm going to try to synthesize, consolidate here. They ask, Are there any quick water-saving tips beyond turning the faucet off when we're not using it? One of the examples, I think, is like the brick in the toilet or whatever that people use. Are there some other ways that people could do this, since the focus does seem to be behavioral? Lou Ann Baker.
There are obviously a lot of appliances now, and we'll start with things that cost money and then things that don't cost money. Water-saving appliances, dishwashers, washing machines, today are manufactured to incredible standards compared to those that are 10 years older or older. Huge uses. The water irrigation is far and large the largest segment of where water goes that people can really think about how to use more effectively. They can think about other uses in their house. If you have a hose outside, does it have a nozzle on it? If you're filling a swimming pool, is it covered that stops it from evaporating? If you're watering your beds and your flower beds, are you watering them with cans rather than with a hose or a sprinkler that's instead watering your sidewalk? Adjusting your sprinklers, because you can water the concrete as long as you want, but I assure you it's likely not going to grow.
Not going to grow more concrete. Okay.
Using a broom instead of a hose to sweep off your walk or your driveway. Things like David's talking about the rain gardens. The reason that that's important is because it focuses the water back into the aquifer. Believe it or not, things like washing your car in your yard instead of in your driveway is a great thing to do, because the water then percolates down back into the aquifer, doesn't go into the stormwater system that then goes to the sewer plant that then goes downstream to Martinsville and other places, which are great towns, don't get me wrong, but that was our water, you know, and we've paid to clean it and use it. So things of that nature that people can just think of within, again, their daily behaviors.
David, do you have something?
Well, the other thing about it is there's a lot of natural things to look at. Composting is important. You know, people don't realize, everybody likes to put everything they want down the grinder. The grinds are very costly, and the cost of treatment is there. We have, through the Office of Sustainability, a lot of places where people can go and take toxic materials, paints and all that, which they don't. Some people just try and dump them somewhere. Can't tell you how many times we bring them out of culverts, which means they get to the sewage plant, and it means that they get to the water plant. You know, habits of, you know, trying to be clean, oil changes, and then letting that just drip down the sidewalk, which goes into the stormwater system, which goes into your creeks. You know, the more we pollute, you know, the worse, the more costly it is to take care of it. And so there's some of those things. Rain barrels are important, some things to look at. People who put new homes in, you know, a white roof is much cheaper, you know, reflects more. There's things you can do that go on. Thinking about, and for industries and companies in town, to start looking at some of the sustainable solutions such as energy efficiencies, because if you save energy, if you save on what you use in your day-to-day life, it all finally comes back to the water system. And right, wrong, or different, either through sewage and or water, it all impacts us. So the less energy we use, the less power we use, the more we conserve on those things, the better off we are as a community going forward. I will point out, though, and just for those who've been asking about the $3.5 billion, we have looked at a 50, you know, the mayor had a big thing about what does it look like 50 years from today.
Mm-hmm.
And we're making sure that the systems we put in and the things that we're doing are standard. That's why the EPA called the consent decree negotiations we did a win-win for them, because it's the first time a city said, we're not going to stop doing it. We're going to do it better. We're going to do it faster. We're just going to use good technology. And that's why right now we're one of the cities that are using green solutions and measuring them, because throughout the country there aren't a lot of measurements on the impacts of green gardens and rain gardens and green alleys and pervious pavement. We're going to try and do that, because then I can go back and see the EPA again, so that's bringing the cost down even further.
Mm-hmm. Lou Ann Baker.
One of the things I'd mention to your listeners is that we've been able to leverage about $3 million in grants from state, federal, and private foundations. And we have active watershed groups at Morse, at Eagle Creek, and at Geist. And I know there are others with Pleasant Run and Fall Creek as well. Those are local grassroots efforts where you have neighbors who are working on management plans, who are working to educate people within their neighborhoods about all of the kinds of things that we're talking about. There's actually an organization, the Upper White River Watershed Association, that has a great website I'd encourage your people to visit. They have a great program called Clean Water, Clear Choices. You can take a pledge to not use phosphorus fertilizer. Challenge your neighbors, challenge your Boy Scout troops, whatever groups you want to get into, again, to look at the information that's out there to help educate yourselves as to what role you can play and what assets and positive educational opportunities exist.
In the time that we've got left here, it probably is wise to turn the corner and talk a little bit about what the future does hold here. David Sherman, you made the point that the mayor has asked for a 50-year projection. What are our needs? What are we looking at 50 years from now? I mean, what is your thinking and the research on that shown us so far? And Angela Hamm, I'd like you to jump in too.
If we keep going at the rate we're going, we're currently ranked 49th in the country for our water quality. So we obviously can't continue that trend, or else we will have significant water availability issues because we will have so polluted our waterways. We're hoping at Hoosier Environmental Council that in the next 50 years that we will be able to limit some of the nutrients that are in our waterways through effective management of our agricultural sources of those nutrients, that we will also be limiting the pharmaceuticals that go in our waterways. That's one thing that hasn't been addressed here. We have evidence of huge amounts of pharmaceuticals that occur in our waterways, not only from human consumption, improper disposal, and agriculture, but also agriculture use. So we're looking to regulate those as well. We're hoping not to have such huge impacts from the coal mining industry here in the state of Indiana, that we can find some way for them to be regulated under a more effective permit that will not degrade our waterways. And hopefully, even though it's been in the works for over 20 years now, we'll have an effective anti-degradation rule, which will require anybody that does apply for a permit to show that they're not going to degrade our waterways any further.
Is there a chance, you talk about how we're 49th and all of that, that if we don't make changes in this state, that we'll run out of drinkable water? I mean, is that a danger at some point? If so, how far away is it?
I think the likelihood of running out is kind of a far-fetched idea. What will likely happen is that it will cost more to treat the water that we have, which is certainly, again, not anything anyone wants to hear with today's economy.
And do we agree, by the way, that we're 49th? Where did that number come from? Is there consensus here among the folks?
I can tell you that IDEM does not agree that we're 49th. I have heard that directly from the commissioner's lips. He does not understand where the entities that rank water quality, like Forbes, like other magazines that come out on a regular basis and do rank states based on their environmental or greenness.
Okay.
He does not agree with that ranking.
So where did we get it from, though?
We got it from several different sources, several different green living publications. It's scientifically validated by different factors that each of these publications look at very different factors when putting this together. But mostly from the fact that we have 822 impaired water bodies in the state of Indiana, and that's an EPA figure.
Well, and I guess I noticed that in an IBJ story, the American Society of Civil Engineers gave our sewer and water infrastructure here in the state a D-. With the money we're spending, what grade is it likely to bring us up to, David Sherman?
Well, knowing the system we're putting in and we're going to go, I'm sure we'll be in the B-plus area. They never like to give out A's.
Mm-hmm. They grade like I do, then.
Pardon me?
They grade like I do, then.
Probably the way I do, too, yeah. But I understand. Right. But, you know, we're putting a very sophisticated system in, something that's going to be affordable for the community. We're putting in a system that's going to have great water quality. It's going to impact the streams and areas. We're not going to have the overflows. People aren't going to hit. I think one thing that we've kind of got away from here is we're going to take 700 septic systems that may be failing or having problems that impact the water system, and we're getting those absorbed during this time. And so between now and the year 2025, places that are actually contaminating or potentially contaminating water systems are getting cleaned up. So I think we will have one of the more unique community areas. I think we believe that we will come up with ways to use stormwater. We will come up with ways to recharge. We are coming up with standards on fog so that people who are paying are actually bringing more grease and fuels and oils into our system are going to pay their price. So I think we're on the track to go in a very good direction, because I hope my kids are still living here in 50 years.
Well, and I guess in the more short-term future, to with a couple of minutes we've got left here, I'd like to talk a little bit about the transfer to Citizens Energy Group, what the impact is likely to be there. David Sherman.
Well, obviously I've been engaged in that process since I came on board. For those who don't know, I spent a large part of my life in the private sector, you know, privatizing and coming up with public partnerships. What I think is going to happen is Citizens has got five utilities. We'll have five utilities. We'll be allocating synergy for those. We'll be allocating efficiencies. I think the people that have been doing most of the work will be absorbed and moved into the system. So I'm expecting that on whatever the day is, the day after, it'll run without a hitch. I think that the city and the operators will be playing an active role going forward. And I think that we will be happy with the long-term savings. You know, we were looking at $104 for sewage bills in the year 2025 to pay for all this that we were going for. The city had made some cuts, but they'll be probably down like $69 by that year, which is a great savings.
And how long a process will it be in terms of the transfer?
Well, the transfer, we're doing transition meetings every day or every week. We're working on things, Citizens and ourselves. Of course, a representative from Citizens isn't here, but we are meeting with them. We're hoping when the IURC approves it, within 30 days, it's over in their hands, and we're not going to let go real quick. We'll make sure it goes well.
Well, and have the issues at the IURC slowed things down at all, or is that?
I think the IURC, I've seen a lot of these things go, most of them, you know, 15 months on a regular, you know, and this one we're hoping to get it done by early spring, but it could fall in a month. But I don't think anything going on with the IURC administration is really having an impact as much as just going through the process.
This has been a fascinating discussion. I'd like to thank you all for joining me. And I also would like to apologize to several of our listeners. We have a lot of tweets and emails and some calls that I just was not able to get to. I would like to thank my guest today, Indianapolis Public Works Director David Sherman. David, thank you for joining us, answering questions. Appreciate it. Veolia Water VP of Communications and Community Affairs, Luann Baker. Luann, thank you for being here. Really appreciate it. And Hoosier Environmental Council Water Policy Director, Angela Hamm. Angela, thank you for joining us today. We're going to take next week off for some special holiday programming. Hope all of you enjoy your Thanksgiving. We will be back on December 2nd when we'll be talking about issues of faith and spirituality. Please do join us. I'm John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host for No Limits. Have a good week. Take care.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Executive Director, Mary Hartnett. Producer, Sharon Alsett. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Josh Hamig. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, and you can listen online at WFYI.org.